Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure for me to be able to talk to you today and present our ongoing work and project. And this is kind of a very more technical kind of talk, and I will try to convey the basic ideas of what we're planning to do here with the satellite. And as the title already suggests, we're planning to do quantum optics applications and experiments in space. But also this is a kind of a status report on these activities because for some of you, you'll remember that about a year ago, we already got together at several occasions at PI in informal meetings to discuss exactly what kind of interesting science experiments could be maybe done by sending quantum systems or entangled quantum particles or photons over long distances in space in different scenarios, like relativistic scenarios. Could we see something interesting? And now, so this was about a year ago. I'll have a little slide about that again, summarizing what was discussed. And just for your timeline, since then, we've been working a lot with the Canadian Space Agency, as well as with a company called ComDev in Cambridge, on actually coining out such a possible mission, distilling from all of those various ideas which were around, and there are a lot of ways of also of doing such an experiment, distilling the most, how should I say, feasible or practical solution. And and now we have a pretty good technical concept of what we're planning or proposing to do. So, and this is what I'll be talking about today. So just for a brief introduction of my own research lab, it is called the Quantum Photonics Laboratory at IQC. We started off a bit more than 2 years ago, 2009. And so mostly my work is focusing on bringing quantum technologies, quantum applications, a step further towards real applications, real world applications. So developing quantum devices, for example, is one of the topics. And in particular, we have a lot of activities on various types of entangled photon sources in my lab. And also, one of the interests which has been with me ever since I entered quantum optics experiments, that is to do long distance experiments with photons. And this is what the remainder of the talk will be about in the end, right? How can we do long distance experiments? but also, we have a fair bit of fundamental quantum experiments in my lab also, like novel states of quantum entanglement, or higher dimensional systems, such kind of fundamental tests. So these are the various people who are involved, in particular on the satellite-based or long-distance-based experiments. Maybe all of them, only Krista Schaum, who's actually a joint postdoc between Kevin Resch's lab and mine. He's maybe amongst those people, the only one not involved in the satellite project in some sense. And then there's, of course, a whole range of collaborations within IQC and actually beyond for all of those activities. So what we are trying to achieve is to establish or implement a Canadian quantum satellite or quantum experiment on a Canadian satellite. And I mentioned already, this has been investigated with an ongoing study with the Canadian Space Agency, CSA. So that's the acronym, which I might be throwing out a couple of times. So Canadian Space Agency. And there are two key kind of goals we want to accomplish. One is to demonstrate QKD at larger scales of distances, and ideally on a global scale. And the other part is also, can we do some quantum science experiments with such a system? And in particular, they should be interesting, so they should be in a regime which is not possible on the ground in terms of distances and velocities. The other kind of objective was, which makes it also challenging, this should be a near-term kind of project. Near-term is still, it depends on your perspective. We're talking having something in 3 years or something, such a kind of a time scale. For satellite projects, that's actually really fast. So that was one kind of key thing we always have in mind, is to try to develop a technology which can be essentially realized with a fast in relatively fast track. I already mentioned the key objectives, but of course, it should also lead the path for longer term visions, and I'll be discussing that a little bit about the fundamental science tests, and now this ties into those meetings and discussions we had here in particular with members of the Perimeter Institute, where we discussed all kind of crazy fancy ideas which could maybe be done, and it turns out a lot of them are still in the phase of being ideas, and will be interesting on the longer term timescale. So this just summarizes. Yeah, we've been writing a little report, and there is like a list of several kind of possible things which are around, and this is just a quick summary of the various concepts which were bounced around. So generally, there would be a huge interest in extending the distances of quantum entanglement tests and finding out the limits of quantum mechanics. So longer distances, of course, is one. And in particular, there would be interest in closing the loopholes, like having space-like separation of measurements and so on. And maybe even in the future, involve free will in bell-type experiments. Now, that's a particularly strange condition to achieve, because free will of people, it requires a pretty long time to establish free will. So people have made measurements on when somebody have to choose pressing either of two buttons, that choice, so once they've decided, that choice has already built up in the mind, so more like a second ago already, the pattern starts to emerge. So now what that means is, if we want to be space-like separated and include something like free will, then distances will have to accomplish, take care of that. And we're talking, if we want to have seconds, we're talking light seconds of distances. So that's like roughly Earth-Moon distance for Bell tests. So clearly, such kind of things are long-term, right? Interaction with Einstein's relativity, so it can be in the sense of having high velocities. There, it would be interesting what happens with entangled or quantum systems as such, right? When we go from one reference frame to another, and there might be relativistic kind of speeds already involved. That's a very interesting type of thing. It is known, for example, that such kind of transformations can introduce changes to polarization states, but this is nothing. It's not like essentially decoherence. It's still reversible essentially, but still, it would be something to look out for. Another very interesting one would be that's one of my personal favorites. Maybe if we have observers moving relative to each other, and they both are detecting entangled, so one photon of an entangled pair, but since they have relative motion there, the time of instantaneity is out of sync, right? Or they have their own different timescales, and if the scale of the experiment is set right, it can happen that either of the observers detects the photon before the other one has been detected in their respective reference frame. So you can have a situation where both observers think they measured before the other. So it's a before-before situation. Or when they're moving towards each other, they'll both be after the other one. So, right? So neither is the first. And this leads to kind of, at least if one has kind of more of a classical kind of interpretation of wave functions and the collapse, then those kind of concepts would be hard to hold, right, or keep up. And so that's certainly very interesting. There is some other issues like for instance, gravitational potentials, can that lead to some decoherence effects? In particular, Tim Ralph is working on a theory which would indicate that maybe if you measure entangled photons at different altitudes, there could be a dephasing effect happening which could wash out the correlation time of the entangled photons. And that would be something which would only happen for entangled photons and not if they're in separable states. So that would be a very interesting direction too. However, I do need to point out that those kind of things it's still in the regime of being speculative in the sense of new physics. It's not really established as such. But still, if we can have an experiment which can maybe do some tests, put some bounds maybe on such kind of effects, it would also be interesting already. Then we've also been discussing, can we see something of the granularity of space-time, right? Discretization. Can there be some effects which show up? And actually, David Rideout in particular was doing some analysis on that, and like he was looking at polarization, diffusion of polarization due to these kind of effects, and he came up with a number in the rotation, the for our kind of setup, we're talking of 1,000 kilometers maybe in space, we would observe something like 10 to the minus 18 of relative depolarization, which is very difficult to measure given that our experiments are more like 10 to the minus 2 precision. So we're just a few orders of magnitude away. But nevertheless, it's important to think about those things. There might be regimes where something turns up. In particular, if we think long-term in the future, we might be sending spacecrafts to the other end of the solar system or beyond. Bigger timescales, yes, it's or different regimes of velocities or anything is, in principle, I mean, a lot is possible. What is also kind of, now I'm already turning it over to that part, this discussion, right? A lot of things, the technology can do a lot for us, but what is still not there is a clear case of why to do those kind of experiments. I'll try to give you an example. If we had discovered, or in those talks, somebody had come up with the idea of, hey, if we send a photon, you know, this close past the sun and measure it on the other side, we'll be able to test string theory, for example. So please don't shoot me if I say something bad. But I'm just trying to be a little pushy here. So if we would come up with such an idea, and if it has the potential to be a real game changer in the terms of experiments and a real step forward, I'm sure there is a way of finding the technology to do that. So it is good to think about those kind of things. So all of this is still ongoing. We are still in contact with various people. But then in the end, we had to try to distill a couple of those ideas down to something into a practical regime, which could be done with something like the satellite we're proposing. And in particular, the system we're kind of proposing essentially is a small kind of satellite, a so-called microsatellite, in a low Earth orbit, maybe a few hundred kilometers height, so it's constantly circling us. And in particular, we're considering sending the photons from the ground to space. And why would that be? Why would that be an interesting thing to do? Because the photon receiver hardware is comparatively simple compared to the source parts. So the satellite, the core elements would be some kind of telescope which can collect the photons, and a photon analyzer and detector. So some photon detectors and electronics. And then it needs some classical communications to communicate the data with the ground. And this box here would just describe the functionality of pointing. So the telescope, of course, would have to point towards the source, which is sending the photons. And that would be already the key functionalities we would need. So again, the aim was to keep it simple. Whereas on the bottom part, I don't have it right. I have a slide a little later about the ground station segment. But since it's on the ground, what we need is a telescope to point to that satellite. And there we can put various quantum sources, whichever are most suitable for those particular experiments. In particular, by putting an entangled source on the ground, we can measure one photon on the ground, the other one in space, and have already some long distance test of entanglement. Or the satellite is moving in respect to the ground station. So we can already test some of the aspects of having moving observers, right? The satellite is moving in respect to the Earth. So and again, the harder parts we can keep on the ground, the source and maybe some kind of complicated timing alignment and those kind of things. Doing stuff on the ground is always like an order of magnitude easier, which in the end relates to dollars. That's another constraint that we have. Sorry, there was a question. So here we are using polarization. It turns out when you send photons through free space, polarization is the most suitable one, degree of freedom, because it is effectively not changed by atmosphere. So other degrees of freedom, like spatial mode, clearly spatial mode would be turbulence would distort it. Time bins is tricky because you have different time slots, and then you have to do interference to identify them. And so polarization is the one which is not affected, or it's only well below any of our precisions where polarization could be changed. Is that good? You see? Okay, I'm glad to hear. So if we do such a entanglement verification, often we're just asked, that's the kind of scheme, but how do you do it actually in the experiment? And oh dear, I just noticed the figures are slightly grainy. So what this plot would show is, what we have worked out is by looking at photon count statistics. So we have on this axis the number of total photon pairs which would be collected. The scale is that this here would be 1,000, 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4, 10,000. And on the other side, we have the entanglement visibility, which is like a kind of a measure of this quality of the correlation. So one is perfect, 90%, 80% is over here. And so what we can tell is, okay, if I say have, let's say 85% visibility, which is actually pretty, not too hard to achieve in the lab, we require on the order 1,000 photon pairs. And so that gives us, again, an idea of how many photons we need to collect. The satellite passes over in a short time, just a few minutes, it will be gone, right? Can we get enough photons at all across, and with which quality? And then we can do a lot of analysis of such kind of link loss, for example. We can have link loss is characterized in decibels, right, the logarithmic scale. And we can look at the visibility of the entanglement, which is pretty high at the beginning, and then it drops off at some kind of loss, let's say 40 dB, 50 dB, and so on. And so we can judge how good does our link have to be. And so what I'm trying to indicate here already is that given that our channel is like 30 to 40 dBs, getting 90% or more than 90% visibility is a feasible task to do. And therefore, doing an entanglement test such as a Bell the condition for this curve is to violate a Bell inequality by 3 sigma, 3 standard deviations, taking into account counting statistics and all that. But the other thing we would also verify here is here we have kind of a dependence of entanglement quality with the distance. And this would be also interesting from a scientific point of view is as the satellite is moving, we might have different distances of that arm which is traveled. And in particular, we could maybe have one photon, the one measured on the ground, run through a delay and delay when the measurement happens. And so we can essentially time, so this one will have a certain flight distance, which depends on where the satellite just happens to be. And here we also will be measuring at a certain delay time. And so we can kind of scan over various delays and distances that the entangled photons cover. And then we can compare those results with the plots I just showed you, where we essentially compare the results we observe with all kind of known error sources, sources of noise. And then why am I telling you this? So what we're looking for is to verify that the quantum entanglement does not have some kind of strange other decoherence effect happening. So such as, for example, this gravitational decoherence, which I mentioned earlier on, right? Because one photon is sent up and measured at a different potential. And so by verifying results with, if our measurement data matches these kind of predictions, which include the known error sources, we can maybe pull out bounds. That's the goal. Obtain some kind of ideas and bounds for such hidden effects. Okay, that's kind of summarizes the science experiments which could be done with this type of system. I just want to see if I, the special relativity one is also that at least potentially with this kind of system, if we could tune the delay just in such a way that the photon up here and the photon on the ground are measured at the same time more or less, let's say in the lab frame, then we would already have that situation that the satellite, which is moving at 7.5 kilometers per second, we could reach that area or regime, at least for a short time maybe, where both observers either measure after each other or before each other. So that's one of the also other very interesting aspects. So the other goal for this kind of system will be to do quantum key transfers over larger distances and in particular global scales. Quantum key distribution, it's essentially what quantum key distribution does is exchange a key between two users, Alice and Bob, by exchanging qubits or information encoded onto single photons in our case. And the security comes from the fact that single qubits or single quantum systems cannot be cloned perfectly. So if somebody would try to manipulate or detect the photons, that will lead to errors which can be detected. So that's in the quick version of QKD. Now why is that Yeah, I mean, of course, there are several ways of doing QKD, and so this is just a summary of a really brief one of the status of QKD technology today. Most importantly, there's one company which is really selling systems, so you can just go and buy it, ID Quantique. But there are actually many other large industrial corporations interested in QKD, working on QKD. Toshiba Labs is one example. AT&T, for example, in the US. Telcordia. There are several all over the place. And also, there have been several networks demonstrated. For example, there was one in not long ago in Europe, in Vienna, where several point-to-point links were connected and a secure network around the city was established. DARPA also had one. Last year in fall, actually, there was one in Tokyo as well. That was the most recent one, where there was, as far as I know, they had one of the fastest link at the moment, which is 1 megabit per second of secure key, which is done by Toshiba Labs. Also, very importantly, it is that industrialization, for industrialization, that there are standards for QKD, so that is also happening at the moment with the so-called ETSI, which is a European Standardization Institute. So there's a lot happening with QKD. QKD is coming, or is already outside of labs and can at least potentially be purchased. So you could have your own quantum technology at home if you wanted. There is one aspect that the current distances and performance are maybe not really quite so interesting yet. And I tried to illustrate this on a map. So we are in the center of this map, right? And current systems can do around 100 kilometers of fiber. So if it's installed fiber, you might have such a kind of a circle maybe. So from Waterloo to Toronto would kind of be the limit. Pushing it with detectors and sources and everything, one could maybe go to 200 kilometers, extend the circle of operation, but then there's not much further one can go on the ground. The main reason is that on the ground, if we send photons through optical fibers, it's very nice, it's a very well-established technology, but the loss is the photons always get absorbed exponentially with the distance. What it means is if you go twice as far, you have twice the dB, but that's an exponential drop already. And that's why, you know, if we improve the detectors massively, we can only gain a few more kilometers. And that's the motivation of such a satellite. But I do have to mention, of course, that a satellite, I mean, global, generally, having a QKD kind of network and a QKD infrastructure is a bigger thing than just the distance. I do have to point this out, right? That we have to develop certain systems and standards and so on. But the satellites, I think, are one clear goal towards demonstrating or establishing global networks. One could imagine having one network at one location and another network, a citywide network at a different location. Each of them have their satellite kind of networks, which can be done in that kind of radius. But no, I meant fiber optic network. But the connection in between is done by, for example, by a satellite, which at some point in time passes over that ground station near that city, and a little later over another ground station at the other network, and exchanges a quantum key between those two sites. And so the satellite would be one piece of a big picture infrastructure. I do need to point out, of course, quantum repeaters are also a viable or an interesting approach of establishing ultra long distances. But at least at the moment, quantum repeaters are still in a very fundamental stage in terms of implementations. There are a lot of technologies which still have to be developed. and are still not there yet. Satellites, on the other hand, and as I'm pretty sure about this by now, that with today's technologies, it can be done. It's not like we're waiting for technology to happen. It is more like it all has to be brought together. So how could we establish such a key? And one method is to use the satellite as a trusted node. So we have this user site at one location, and there's a quantum link happening as the satellite passes over, and we create a key between the user A and the satellite, and it's stored on the satellite. The satellite would pass over, and at a later time, pass over the user B, and create a separate independent quantum key at this site. Another satellite has two different keys, and with the two different ground stations. Now the satellite can compute the bitwise XOR of those two keys, like a sum, a bitwise sum, communicate this to one of the users, and by simply applying, doing the same operation, the bitwise sum of one key with the sum again of the two keys, out would pop the other key. And in that way, two users could establish the same copy of the key, or get identical keys. And then the two users can use that for their whatever purposes for communication. So satellite QKD worldwide is already happening, so we're not the only ones working on it. I think probably one of the early pioneers was in the USA, in particular Richard Hughes, who did a lot of effort already and in developing systems, understanding how they could work, and showing the feasibility also in experiments. ESA is working on a similar system, but it's more geared towards science. The idea is to put an entangled source onto the International Space Station, because the European part of the space station still has some available spots for research. This project is called Space Quest, by the way. But it's a more technically advanced or a demanding situation, because one would need to have the entangled source and send both photons to two ground stations at the same time. So technically, it's a big challenge. Japan is also very interested, and in particular, Japanese have a lot of experience with developing laser terminals in space, so laser communication. And they are also now thinking of doing some QKD demonstrator on their next generation laser terminal. In China, China has announced about a year ago that they're working on their own QKD satellite. And in fact, they're talking of a launch date of 2016. And apparently there's a lot of activity going on and a lot of research. And they're collaborating with the Vienna group, my former lab. And actually there have been many more in the UK or in Italy, and also in Spain there are activities. So various other nations are looking into it also, like also in Asia, there's Malaysia, Singapore, and there's various people interested. But as far as we know, up to date, nobody has active QKD in space as of yet, right? So it's still an open activity. So in terms of technology, I was already mentioned the key kind of ideas. I pointed out already, sending photons up gives us the most flexibility, and we can keep the sources on the ground, the complex parts on the ground, and in particular, that's now comes this concept of the ground station, which I mentioned. So here we would have a telescope which points towards the satellite as it passes over. And then what we would do is we could have different types of experiments which we could switch into the system depending on what is planned, right? So this would be, for instance, for pure QKD, we could have a faint laser module creating weak coherent pulses, or an entangled photon source. It could also be photon detectors if we have, let's say, some laser on the satellite sending down. But it could even be we're talking also with people doing quantum memories, quantum dots maybe, all kind of different types of sources could be implemented here. And the other nice feature is that the transmitter is relatively small in aperture. So this one is actually a 40 centimeter one. So it's a pretty compact system. So not necessarily a large investment. Why 25 and not like a larger one? The reason is atmosphere would distort the beams anyway. So if you have an aperture larger than 25 centimeter roughly on the ground, your beam divergence is already limited by turbulence. And that's what astronomers are actually also fighting with. So in many astronomy experiments, the larger telescopes are more for collecting more photons and not always for getting better resolution. Then they can only do that by going to better locations. So that's why they have telescopes on nice high mountains or using adaptive optics. The quantum channel itself is a challenge because if we have a quantum source on one side and the detectors, photon analyzer and detector on the other side, and in between, we'll have a variable distance, right? The satellite is moving really fast, and this distance changes at a rapid rate. And at the same time, we wanna be able to correlate the event of the source T1 and the detection T2 to better than half a nanosecond, which relates, this corresponds to 15 centimeters in free flight of the photons. So we are essentially measuring, or we have to be able to determine the path at any instant in time down to 15 centimeters, so 1,000 kilometers. But all of that can be done, and there are several approaches we're pursuing. So essentially what happens is, believe it or not, satellites also have GPS receivers on board for their own navigation. And so essentially what we can do is we will be able to record the GPS data at a certain interval of time. And then from that we can backtrack and figure out where was the satellite exactly. And this can be done down to centimeter resolution in the end. So that's in a brief explanation how it could work. But GPS would only be one means for us. We would have other methods of synchronization as well. Oh yes, and another thing is polarization will need to be aligned. So even though atmosphere doesn't disturb polarization, we have to make sure that whatever polarization state we send off, that the reference frame on the satellite is in sync. This can be done by sending, for instance, a reference laser, a strong beam, in parallel to the photons and measuring the rotation and using that to do corrections on the polarization. The good news is that satellites, they move pretty fast, but also pretty constant. So it's a very smooth, it's free fall, right? So the motion is very predictable and very smooth. So the drift of polarization will also be correspondingly smooth and predictable. An important part, so again, this is all very technical, but an important part for us to understand was exactly how good do our photon sources and detectors have to be, and to understand the link in order to know how many photons will make it up there. And
some people were working on a kind of adaptive telescope that would change their shape to cancel out the effect of the atmospheric fluctuations.
Exactly.
Is that doable?
Yeah. So this would be important. I'll just illustrate it here that, so if we send a beam up here through the atmosphere will introduce phase distortions on the wavefront, and that will make the beam diverge, and the beam will spread out more. So what happens is that once it reaches the satellite, it will have spread out more than just due to the aperture itself. That's turbulence induced, and in fact, so-called adaptive optics can what it does is it So it could take a laser beam going down, use that as a reference to measure the phase distortion on that laser, and then pre-compensate. So in here, before the beam, as the beam is leaving the telescope, to impose a wavefront distortion, which is just the opposite, so the conjugate, so that in the end, it kind of cancels out. This is usually done with deformable mirrors. So there are mirrors which with little actuators at the back, and they can, so they have like hundreds of elements, and each of them can move like a few micrometers back and forth. So by the bare eye, you can't see anything changing, but it's still, it's tuning the wavefront of the beam. Right now, we're investigating with, actually with INO in Quebec, exactly if this can be applied to this situation. It's used widely in astronomy for imaging and improving the imaging resolution. But in astronomy, the objects are typically much slower than the satellite. The satellite moves over the whole sky in a few minutes. And so it's a high speed, kind of at least a relative motion. And so it's not totally clear if this atmospheric correction can work and how much it will bring. The key reason is that the downgoing beam, by the time it's been analyzed and the photons go back, the satellite has already moved. And so the outgoing beam would pass through a slightly different section of the atmosphere. So that's one of the challenges we're looking at.
First application with adaptive optics was on satellites.
Yeah, apparently they were using it to image satellites. Is that right?
No.
No?
They were using it to look down.
Oh, on satellites. Yeah.
I don't know if they can. You have to have one on the ground if you want to get.
Yeah. So I do also know this kind of technology has been also developed to point lasers at things. So in particular, this kind of Star Wars type of technology, they were also trying to focus laser at objects far away, moving fast. And there was also a lot of development of adaptive optics for that purpose. And I mean, in some sense, it's similar, right? Only here we're talking where we just want to focus. All we want to do is focus our photons onto the satellite. But it's still kind of related to focusing a laser beam onto something. So, but yeah, it is widely developed, and it's always a challenge by itself, as far as we know. But yes, we are looking into it. But if anyone has any good information, I'd be more than interested to hear about it. So the challenge then is, first of all, satellite is moving. And every time it passes over somewhere else on the sky, right? And so we get a distribution of flight durations over, this is like 1 year. 500 seconds is the most prominent time, and then if the satellite is slightly on the side, it will be shorter. And this kind of relates to, for each pass, to the elevation angle. So where do you see the satellite? And then we can relate it to loss. We can say, for each angle where the satellite is visible, I have a certain loss. Now this includes diffraction, turbulence, detectors, all kinds of things. And then one can get a final number. And we then essentially convolute those things. We have the passes coming over. We have such kind of figure sets for given parameters. And then we can figure out what is going to be our average loss for a certain pass. We have to include things like background from the sky. So there's a lot of light pollution around. This is, and actually one can find a global map even of that. People have done a lot of measurements. We are up here. I think the lakes are, I think, hey, around here somewhere. That's where we are. So yeah, has to be taken into account. A selection of a good choice location will certainly also be crucial, at least in the first types of experiments. And then taking this into account, we can then figure out how many of the passes will actually be useful at all. And also what we do is we simulate in quantum, we do a quantum optics model, so simulating the photons, so in Fock space, the photon statistics of the sources and the detectors. And so for every type of loss, and we can figure out the instantaneous count rates and the visibility. And I'm sorry if all of this is very boring, but I've been spending my last 2 years almost, or 1 year looking on, mostly focusing in this kind of analysis. And then what we get is things like, okay, how many counts do we get over the elevation angle, or what is the visibility of the entanglement for a given elevation angle, all of that. And then finally, one can come up with a table like this and say, if my ground station has 25 centimeters and my receiver in space has 40 centimeters, then I will have, like, what is one example? We can look at this one. The average number of counts will be 300,000 for one pass. This is one example, right? Or I can have a secure key of 13,000 bits for this set of parameters. They're like tons and tons of such tables which we have to work out and distill. The key message is, though, all of that can be used to figure out the actual parameters of the experiment. We've also been working actively in the lab on an experiment. And what we were showing here is, in particular, so what we see here is the secure key rate versus the acceptable loss for QKD. And we were able to go well above 50 dB, close to 60 decibel even, for the channel loss. And what we had to do is, again, we tried to simulate the receiver part and the source part. And we implemented a very complicated type of source, assuming it's on the ground. But it's based on a short femtosecond pulsed laser, actually picosecond pulsed laser, and high-speed polarization modulators. And then we create green photons, which are weak coherent pulses. But they are very well timed. That's the key kind of piece of technology we needed here. And most QKD systems today, they cut off around 40 dBs. And so by improving the technologies and also the time analysis and various other things, we have been able to push it further. And also this supports the whole concept of these kind of experiments where the more loss we can accept, the more feasible it will become. So what is the status and what is the ongoing activity? Currently, it is all under the supervision of the CSA, the Canadian Space Agency. We've been working with COMDEF as the as the prime contractor, as it's called. And then so we have essentially the science partner, us, IQC, but also in collaboration with Perimeter and also from Calgary, some guys on the science side, the quantum application side. And COMDEF, of course, is in charge of the satellite system itself. So it's, when I came here, I was so amazed to hear that there's a real satellite manufacturer so close by there in Cambridge, right? So that was. It's so great to have them close by. And this is also why this collaboration is working that well. And also, we're working with INO in Quebec, who's experts for optical components and devices. So I pointed out already we're right now, in terms of timeline, we're right now still completing the so-called phase zero, which is the mission requirements and the mission concepts, which are defined. And this is a picture of the current design. The satellite itself would be like, this is like 80 or something centimeters across, kind of a cube. Interestingly, it's still called a microsat. Our main component would be this, we can see the telescope here. That would be the main receiver. And then there are some little boxes for some components which are needed, like photon detectors. But that's actually only a small part. The other parts are all for the satellite system itself, like power supplies, control, and computers which are needed. And this little part here, actually, it's funny. This ring is the mounting onto the carrier, the launching vehicle. So we have formed a user team which is in charge of essentially coining out the mission objectives and also would make use of the infrastructure once it's up and ready. So we have science aspect, or already pointed that out. Science and theory with the Parameter Institute, some members, and then the experimental part will be mostly from these partners, at least at the moment. Those are the three main partners. So that's IQC, which would be us, but also in collaboration with University of Toronto and University of Calgary. And we also have some application users, so from the QKD kind of user direction. So one is the Defense Research Development in Canada, and the others are Communication Security Establishment, who are essentially the experts for anything which has to be secured for governmental reasons, purposes. Right. So most of them are arranged located more on the eastern side, but also we have partners at the western side. So finally, that's the summary. The key message is, I think we have identified a interesting feasible system which can do two kind of purposes. It can do QKD demonstrations for global quantum key distribution, as well as also some kind of quantum science experiments. It's maybe not quite the final long-term goals, which one might want to do to be most interesting, but already an important step in that direction. The other things are more technical maybe, but also just as important. It's feasible with today's technology. So we're not talking science fiction. Today's technology can do that. And what I like in particular is that actually a lot of the technologies are available in Canada. That's another interesting aspect. So experimentalists would know this more maybe, that the main manufacturer of photon detectors is actually in Canada, in Quebec. They used to be called PerkinElmer, or a long time ago it was RCA, and they still make up to date the best silicon photon detectors. So everyone uses them around the world. And the concept we've come up of is, at least from a technical point of view, low risk. So there are no major things which have to be developed and done. Okay, well, thank you very much. No, I don't know the real numbers now, but there is still a little bit of margin left. So in terms of size, we were slightly over the size on one end, but they thought they could turn it in a way that it would still work. In the launch is the main. And in terms of power and mass, there's still some room left for like a secondary payload or some other payload. But not too much, of course, but there was some room left.
Would there be any possibility of doing this with a satellite in geosynchronous orbit?
Yes, absolutely. We have run the analysis. I didn't mention that. Before pinning down this particular proposal, we looked at a whole bunch of things, and GEO was one of them. And the one which would be really nice is to have an entangled photon source in GEO and send the two photons down to the ground. And it would be nice because you can see at least almost half the Earth just from one spot, right? So one could, and it would not move. So it would just sit there. You could almost align the telescopes by hand. And we've run the analysis, and it would be cutting edge, but it would also be possible with today's technologies. So yes, it would be. But the reason we wouldn't go there right away is this can't be fast, low cost anymore. Geostationary is really hard to operate in.
And in astronomy, some people use the Luck Image camera instead of this adaptive optics.
Oh, you mean Lucky Imaging?
Luck Image camera. Yeah, don't need the laser beam. They just take very high frequency images and then select the best one that the wavefront is complete and there's no distortion. So,
So you're asking if something similar?
Yes.
In fact, we have recently done a few experiments exactly on that. We call it Lucky Entanglement. It's like what you can do is you can. So all you want to do is you want to use the photons where you know you had a good link. Those ones you can use, and when you can, at the same time you can tell when the link fades away. So let's say the receiver receives fewer photons, and so by cutting out those portions where the link was weaker, and using only the portions where the link was stronger, one can get some improvement. But it's only a little bit, and it's not, we don't know exactly how much it will help, but yes, there is some improvement, yeah.
I mean, any question? Are you planning to use the telescopes only to receive the photons, or are you planning on using it also to sense it?
In space?
In or both?
Well, so there always has to be one is always the sender, the other one the receiver. And so the key mode of operation will be up. So the transmitter on the ground and the satellite receive. But we are thinking of having at least a pulsed laser which can simulate weak photon pulses to go down. So we could switch it on and off and then send photons down as well. But that system will probably only allow to test like a quantum channel, like sending weak photon pulses, but not do a real QKD protocol because that requires a lot of data processing and other stuff which we are planning not to put up. Is that kind of, yeah.
It's just a naive thing that if you have a laser, its aperture is probably relatively small compared to the aperture of the telescope.
That's whatever you set it to be. So if you have a laser and you want to send a laser far away, you have to widen the beam. So you have to make the aperture of the laser, the spot, larger.
I was just wondering whether you can use the telescope for that.
Absolutely, yeah.
What's the best wavelength for the photons to use, sir?
Very good question. Yeah, I didn't even touch on that. Yeah, all those tables I showed, we do also for different wavelengths. And there's a lot of things going on because generally the atmosphere is pretty good in the visible range, and it gets better in infrared even, right, if we go further to longer wavelengths. There are some absorption lines here and there, but so the longer the better. But at the same time, diffraction gets worse the longer you... So they're competing. And what turns out is that around 600 to 800 is a pretty optimal wavelength for the photons. That's a very good question.
But cloud's a problem.
Say again?
A cloud's a problem.
Yes, of course, yes, unfortunately. clouds and fog and other weather.
I mean, in Canada, that might be a big problem.
you're right. Yes.
Worse than England.
But it actually, definitely. Yeah. So the location and the duty cycle of the location will be certainly an issue. But I don't have hard numbers. But the other thing is also it seems worse than it is. You know, but you're right, I should come up with numbers. But I know that I've heard that somebody talking about it, about the rain statistics, right? And people remember when there was bad weather and it rained and then they complained. But then when it's nice and sunny, like today, by the way, right? And then people, it goes not unnoticed.
Presumably people paying for quantum key distribution are not wanting to wait until the weather gets better.
No, you're right. So there will be a duty cycle, yes, absolutely. So it's not clear. So for a real, you know, application like pay-per-bit application, it's not clear how the business model would look like, for example, exactly for such kind of questions. But it might be that in the future we will have other types of photons, like radio photons maybe, or something else, which can make it through. So there are alternatives for that as well.
Location, are you envisaging the roof of the IQC or Hawaii?
That's a nice comparison. So we are in fact trying to set something up on the roof of IQC to do some at least preliminary tests. But it might have to be some better location. And like I showed you that map of light pollution, actually there are a few pretty good spots not too far from here. So you go towards the lakes somewhere, or there are some clearer spots. So where there's light pollution is better. Or we're also considering in the west, so near Calgary, maybe in the mountains. Actually, the University of Calgary has some observatories up on the mountains, and those locations are also very good. But we are hopeful that kind of urban, so not too far away from city kind of locations will work, and that's what, again, supported by atmospheric analysis shows, because also didn't show we run simulations for different types of atmosphere and qualities and pollution, and all that is taken into account. And then one can see that, yes, the clearer the air, the better. But it can work also at even 5 kilometer visibility is enough. So,
considering the news of the last couple of weeks, could you make a last-minute change and equip the satellite with neutrino detectors?
Yes. But if we had great neutrino detectors, we wouldn't need the satellite, right? We could point. You could shoot through the Earth, right?
But this way you could raise a photon against the neutrino directly. But you don't have to measure the distance.
Out of curiosity, how much is all this costing?
So the numbers which are circling around are in the it's $20 to $30 million total. So, but this is only a rough ballpark. I don't know any exact numbers.
Could you repeat the question?
That was actually Achim Kempf is actually the key expert here. No, it was, is it on this slide? It was earlier on, right? You picked out the one thing I didn't mention. No, this idea, what it was about is to, I'm sorry. So that's the one you meant, is that right? This one. So what this one is about, if you think of entangled photons, which are emitted at an unknown time, let's say you have a source which has a long coherence time, then you will get out a photon pair. So they are strictly correlated in time, but you don't know when they were emitted. And now the thinking was, okay, could it we have a situation if we send entangled photons through space in large distances that is not totally clear which path the photons exactly traveled, because it's a huge superposition of many different times and so what do I mean? So the wave packets would have a relatively large extent. But once we did it, but where the photons really are is only decided at the measure, at the point of measurement. And so this would lead to some ambiguity of which path the photon really took.
Two entangled photons that travel two different paths. Now, if the space is curved significantly, or significantly enough, because of gravity, then the parallel transport of the polarization will be affected by that. And therefore, the DPI experiment that you do with that will notice the presence of curvature. So you could use the quantum effect to measure curvature.
Just to remind you that there should be free food, free snacks, free stroke. Okay, let's thank Thomas.